How was WWDC?
WWDC was good. It was the first time that I've ever really done anything like that. I think as somebody who has lived in Florida for most of my life, attending a techie sort of event has always been like a dream of mine that felt fairly far out of reach. We've talked on this show before about how before I liked Apple, I liked video games, and they too have a big California conference called E3. And I remember being younger and really wishing I could go to that and not being able to. And now I am older and wished that I could go to WWDC. And now I did, or sort of did. I didn't actually go to WWDC because it's extremely expensive. And also, I am not the right demographic for that. But I went to the event space and hung out at the coffee shop that seemed to be a alternative meeting spot for the conference itself. And had a great time. So it was fun.
I want to hear things about what you did and who you talked to and what you talked about and what you learned about and all of that stuff. And of course, I want to talk about the software that was announced as well. But can you say more about why you wanted to go to this and why you wanted to go to E3 as a kid and like what the draw to this kind of environment is for you?
Yeah, I think that there's something special about being in the thick of it that changes the way that you see something as opposed to just viewing it from a distance. When I was a kid, I think that if I'm really looking back at it, and not maybe a kid, a teenager, when I was a teenager looking back, it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to go to E3 to play video games because, you know, the video games come out later and I played them then. It was about being in a room full of people that appreciated a thing just as much as I did and cared about it just as much as I did or more. You know, when I was a teenager, I was playing games and I knew that E3 is full of people that were making games and there was something significant about that. In the same way, I think WWDC holds a similar place for me, which is I have always loved Apple and the technology that Apple develops. And I have always been the person that puts the developer beta on my phone way before anybody else has it. I show it to people, they have a mild interest, and then we move on with our day. But at WWDC, I have my developer beta on my phone, and so does like 85% of the population around me. And we're all sitting there and talking about the changes and what the ramifications of each new feature might be. And it's something significant about being around people who are just as amped up about something as you are. I think I've always wanted to be a part of something like that just to see what that felt like. And now I've gone. And it was exactly what I thought it might be, which was more about the community than it was about the technology.
Have we said yet that WWDC stands for Worldwide Developers Conference?
That is important.
The Apple conference for developers that happens every year around this time in early June. And it was held in San Francisco for a long time and has moved in the past couple of years to San Jose, putting it into a much more isolated environment, right? Like before, it was kind of dwarfed by San Francisco and everything going on around it, and found its community at the conference, found its places kind of nestled in the midst of this bigger city. And that's where it was when I did the thing that you just did, swinging by to go to the parties and hang out on the periphery. But now it's like this Apple town for a few days, where it's really all about that community that descends on that place. And a lot more Apple people get to participate as a result of being closer to the office. And it's really changed in character to be a much more self-contained community experience in the past couple of years. So what was your experience with the community, and how much do you feel a part of the community that was descending on San Jose for WWDC?
That's a good question. And maybe the thing that initially comes to mind is to say that I don't think that it's my primary community space, but it might be my secondary community space. So pretty important. It's pretty important to me. As we've talked about for quite a while, Twitter has been something that has always been a big social network for me. And I would classify the kind of Twitter that I have cared about as tech Twitter, mm-hmm. or maybe more specifically Apple Twitter, because it seems as if there are these clusters that can be created in social networks like Twitter. And everyone is sort of following the same handful of people. And the Twitter that I have been a part of for 8 years now, 9 years now, has been the tech one. And as somebody who has a few different like community spaces, including one that is religious, like I don't think of my Twitter as Christian Twitter. I think of my Twitter as tech Twitter. And I think that that kind of says something about how much I care about the community and how much I like it and I'm interested in it and engaged in it. I'm not like a major voice in it. I don't think I've ever had a desire to be contributing majorly to the conversations until really a podcast like this one. But I think that it's something that I've always really felt a part of. A way of thinking about it is that the first trip that I took to San Francisco a few years ago, one of the things that I wanted to see with my eyes was the Moscone Center, which is where WWDC took place for years and years. I just wanted to see it because I'd seen all these pictures of that big wall of glass with the Apple logo overlaid on it specifically for the conventions. And I thought, wow, there's that building. And I remember pointing it out to my wife, and my wife didn't care. She is not a Apple nerd like I am. But that was like one of three things that I wanted to see in San Francisco itself, in the city. So, I mean, when I think about it that way, it kind of gives a bit of resonance to how much it's meant to me, even though it hasn't been something that I've ever really like sought after until I lived in the same state where it was taking place.
And so how about the people? There are a lot of figures in the Apple community who all arrive in at WWDC as a kind of reunion, since so many of them conduct their relationships at a distance over the internet, very much in keeping with our theme here. And surely before you moved to California, but probably even still, like that's like 99.9% of your relationship with the people in this community too. So did you feel like you were going somewhere where there were people that you knew, and how did that affect the experience of being in this physical presence with all these people? Probably people who are seeing the same Twitter as you, but who you may not know of or may have maybe seen online and to various degrees and in various ways, but have never met.
I want to say that I actually really appreciate that turn of phrase, like seeing the same Twitter as me, because I think that's a good way of thinking about what I was trying to get at in saying that these people kind of share the same sphere. Today, for example, a friend of mine was talking about how great the iPhone 10 OLED screen was. And I mentioned, yeah, you know, I was actually worried about that because I think I've read that the iPhone 8 screen is kind of superior to the iPhone 10 screen in some ways. And he was like, oh, what? And, you know, I pulled up the article about how it had this different like pixel structure and all that stuff. And like he had never heard of that, where I assume that if I would have had a similar conversation about that at WWDC when I was in San Jose, I would have got schooled and people would have known 10 times more than I would have about that subject and told me all the little details about it. And it's kind of fun to not be the person that has the most knowledge about the thing that you like. And I certainly didn't feel like I was the person with the most knowledge at San Jose. I felt like I was on the low end of the spectrum. I was really fortunate that I wasn't alone. I had a guide, someone to take me through San Jose and introduce me to people, which was a friend and friend of the show, Matthew Casanelli, who used to be on the workflow team before / slightly during it was acquired by Apple. And he had gone years past. He lives in Oakland and was able to kind of take me around, introduce me to people, let me know where to go and who to talk to. And that was really great. So yeah, I actually don't think that it was as important for me to meet people who I had heard. There were podcasters there and people like John Gruber of Daring Fireball, which is sort of the de facto blog about the Apple industry and Apple company as a whole. And that was cool. Like, it was cool to see those people. It was cool to meet a few of those people. But I think that bigger than that for me was just being surrounded by people who were all like-minded on a similar subject and knowing that I could basically look to my left or my right and know that those people were seeing the same Twitter as I was. Like, I really do think that that was the part of it that struck me as important.
And what did you talk about with these people? How philosophical of a gathering was this versus technical?
I think that I found myself on the more philosophical side of things. I think if I would have met a lot of Apple devs or people that were, you know, devs in the Apple world, I would have found a lot more technical conversation. And I got in a few of those, and you might not be surprised to know that at a certain point, those bore me. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never been the person that cares about the minutiae of a new feature in that kind of way. I like it when they're interesting, but I wasn't the guy constructing a million Memoji to see what the boundaries were.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that was the most technical was, because Matthew was part of the workflow team, he was very invested and interested in Siri shortcuts. And so myself and him spent a good deal of time looking through how that was actually applicable in the Developer One beta and what that might mean. But in that case, I think I was more curious about talking about the future of the platform through the lens of Siri Shortcut than I was about how many shortcuts I could possibly set up on this developer beta and what I could get it to do right now. Because I don't think that is as important to me as the long conversations. Mm-hmm. And I was thankful that I had quite a few of those.
It's really nice that we don't have to backtrack and talk about what those are or what any of the new announcements are. If you don't already know what Drew's talking about, listen to the previous episode of this podcast where we talk about every single thing that came out at WWDC. But what I am interested in is whether that was the Siri shortcuts, I mean, was the primary topic of conversation in terms of features and direction. I would imagine that you could have gotten in a lot of conversations about screen time also. Like, that's something that certainly you and I could spend at least as much time talking about as the potential of Siri shortcuts. Was this the one that really kind of sparked the imagination of the people you were hanging out with the most?
I think that Siri shortcuts was that perfect mix of tech nerdery and future possibility that made people think through quite a bit how that could be in the future. And of course, hanging out with Matthew knew so much about workflow and its transition to this kind of baked-in feature of iOS. So that was definitely a bit of it. Screen time, too, was important. We had a few conversations about that. But I think because it is so clear in its intentions, there wasn't a lot of conversation about it. The conversation was, oh, good, I can do this now. Mm. And a few little things like, maybe you've heard this, maybe you've not heard this. The developer beta revealed that if you have screen time turned on for an app like Twitter, that also means that you cannot go to twitter.com in Safari.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that use like the same URL handlers that like makes it so that it opens the app when you click on a twitter.com link or something? Like, Apple knows what the domain of that app is.
Yes, exactly. So you get the nice hourglass, no more of this app animation overlaid on top of that Safari tab when you try to do that.
Oh, that's so good.
It is very good. So see, this conversation we're having now, that's the conversation that I was having at WWDC about screen time. And that was kind of it.
Huh.
Because other than that, people said, oh yeah, I'll be turning that on and I'm excited to have the bedtime feature or whatever they're calling that. And There is not much more to be said about it.
Okay, so people like it.
People like it.
But they're not sitting around talking about, like, should we be using our phones this much or not? And like, or like, you know,
right,
like the moral weight of that issue that I think you and I both give it.
No.
That wasn't really something that people were into talking about.
The other thing that comes to mind was augmented reality, which was sort of signaled as important, not only by the keynote, but by the fact that The Talk Show Live, which is a sit-down hour-long chat with John Gruber, who I mentioned previously, had two executives sent by Apple, one of them who is the chief vice president, executive, whatever, of augmented reality and virtual reality. So because of that, which many, many people were in attendance of, augmented reality was a bit of a conversation. Mm. But even still, it wasn't much more than interesting. That must mean that it's important. It didn't go too much further than that, which I would have loved to have talked to developers about, but it didn't seem like it was the primary conversation of the day.
It's clearly something Apple is trying to get developers to be interested in and telegraphing about the future. And there were some pretty funny moments in that show where Gruber tried to get into a conversation about our glasses screenless future we never stop talking about, because he knows all of the tricks. He knows where all of the lines are, where all of the things that Apple employees can't talk about are. And he kept playfully getting them in, backing them into corners. So they won't really talk about where things are actually going, but they just wanted to float augmented reality as something that that software developers on these platforms might want to think about getting into at some point.
Which is interesting to think about Apple as this intensely private company that still manages to get hundreds. I mean, how many people even go to WWDC? I have no idea.
A few thousand, I think.
Yeah, not hundreds, but thousands of people together to talk about the future that they will refuse to talk about. So in a way, it sort of feels contrarian that we're all here discussing this company that doesn't like discussing itself and its future plans, trying to build our own timelines in our head of the future of what the platform might be. And not only were there developers, but there were podcasters, there were journalists, there were this and that. And it was kind of fun to watch them start to build narratives around features like Siri shortcuts, but also long game concepts like augmented reality itself, which it's hard. It's hard to figure out how to exactly do that.
So what about Apple employees? Did you get to meet any Apple people and talk to them? And what kinds of conversations could you have with the ones that weren't on stage talking to John Gruber about where things are and where they're going?
What I kind of got was, you know, the sense of community that I feel, I didn't know if the Apple employees themselves felt as well. But I got to say that I think they really do, which is cool. I guess I had never really considered that before. Maybe an example of that, to go back to the gaming thing, is I never had a sense when I was younger that the things that I cared about, or let's say I joined a forum and we all were talking about how great it would be to have this new update or how cool it would be to have a game implement this kind of concept, I would have never in a million years thought that there would have been a person that was developing those games that was listening into that conversation and actually taking notes. Hmm. And I think that I translated that thought to Apple. When I listen to a podcast about Apple, I do not think about Apple employees listening to that podcast. When we have a conversation on Twitter about a bug or a feature that we wished existed or some limitation that we've run into that we don't want to anymore, I don't think that Apple developers are reading those tweets. I think I've kind of got this mental image in my head of all Apple employees busily hurrying along and constantly being at their wits' end, trying to make the things that they've been demanded to bring into reality a reality. And I think that is also true. I think that they are extremely busy people, but I think that just like I listen to the talk show, they listen to the talk show. Mm-hmm. And just as I read a blog or two, they read a blog or two. And just as I see a tweet that has been retweeted by a bunch of people in the Apple community, they see it. And there was something cool in knowing that there's a shared commonality there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I also imagine that it has to be kind of reassuring about one's work to have such a community around it. And it's got to feel good, especially for something that you worked on. You know, a company like Apple, where even if you do something that might be a small part of the job of building a particular feature or something, you're still doing something that affects hundreds of millions of people. And to have this level of community out in the world celebrating and enjoying the effect that that work has on their lives has got to feel good. And I would hope that WWDC is kind of a celebratory experience for a lot of Apple employees, and that they hopefully get a little bit of a rest from that breakneck pace after the features are announced and the betas start going out, and that they can kind of reap the rewards of all that hard work. I think that we would be remiss not to talk about kind of the tribalism and the intensity of the community and the kinds of negative side effects that it can have, especially online. As wonderful as it is to gather together at WWDC, as clear as of a sign as that is that the community is healthy, there are some pretty strongly held feelings about this stuff, and it's really interesting to me to consider where it might come from. And you know, I noticed it in myself this very weekend, actually. I was on a little retreat with my sister-in-law and her partner and my brother and his partner and my wife and I. We had this like sibling country retreat that we took, and it was really great. But we were driving around trying to navigate to the house in the first place. And I had my phone on the dashboard and it was using Google Maps and it was wrong about something. And so my sister-in-law handed me her phone, which was also using Google Maps, but is also an iPhone. But it's an iPhone SE, so it's this old phone that she's had for a while. We were inevitably started talking about the phone, and it comes out that she is a hardline believer in the planned obsolescence conspiracy theory.
Ah, yes, yes.
That updating her, she hasn't updated, she's like running iOS 10 or something, and, you know, updating the OS is a devious plot by Apple to get you to buy more phones. And I lost it. I like completely freaked out. I found myself using the argument that Greg Joswiak used on stage with John Gruber about this very thing. Just the obvious fallacy of like, if a car company sold you a car that broke down after 2 years and it was obviously on purpose, why would you buy another car from them? And like, it just didn't land. It didn't, she didn't, she completely rejected it. She said, and she's used the words, nothing will convince me otherwise.
Oh, that's extreme.
Yeah. And so I found myself in this like religious argument about the planned obsolescence conspiracy theory about Apple. And I'm defending them so stridently. And I had to wonder after it kind of died down a little bit, where all of that energy came from. Hmm. And I've been to WWDC in the same way that you have and hung out with people that, I mean, some of them were clients for me. I've worked as a consultant on some apps in the App Store. So there was a little bit of business going on and a little bit of discussing kind of roadmaps for products and how to talk about them. But really, it did kind of feel like a tribal gathering to me. And the effects of that are still something that I feel pretty strongly from time to time. And there, of course, are stories from the blog days of fighting religious wars about telephone allegiances. I still bear the scars of those struggles. I don't have a theory about why these things inspire such fervor that I can point to, but I know that as high of a height as they could take us to, they also bring us to these very low places. So I guess I have a question. Have you ever personally experienced that kind of zeal about this community and the technology? Have you felt it in yourself, or has it been turned on you from someone else? If so, how is that experience connected to the one of just togetherness and community that you had last week?
Yeah, I was trying to think through if I could recall any similar religious arguments in a very real way. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I mean, I absolutely have that within me. I have an aversion to Android that probably doesn't make as much real sense as it makes a religious type of sense. And I have opinions about Apple as a company, which if I really sat down and like logged them and thought through them, maybe quite a few, I would hope a majority of them are rational and good, but I'm going to go ahead and assume that a few of them are irrational. And I think that is just what comes with loving something, isn't it? Like when you love something, sometimes you have an irrational thought process in your head. Or if not irrational, let's say extreme. Mm-hmm. The thing that you felt, let's use your example of the planned obsolescence conversation. I think that we could sit down and create a rational case for why they wouldn't do that, which is what that Apple executive did at WWDC, saying, of course we don't have planned obsolescence. That would be ridiculous. That would be bad business. And that was sort of his whole point. And he used that example of you wouldn't buy a car from a company that you had just purchased a car and that car broke down. And the response to that was not like nods of affirmation. It was applause and cheering and this, you know, massive laugh that kind of comment got. And I think that reaction is not a rational reaction. I think that is a reaction that's born out of a deep love and appreciation for a thing, and that thing is Apple. And I think that, yeah, that's tribalism, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That is us all wanting to support the tribe that we are a part of. And I don't know about you, but if I really thought about it, I could probably think of some times where I had not felt like Apple had done the best job of caring for their previous products. The iPad mini comes to mind. I think I updated that thing to who knows what iOS 9 or 10 or something, and it ran terribly. And I don't think that that was Apple infecting the iPad mini with something to make it run slower. I just think that they put a really good new operating system on a really old device, and it made it not as good anymore. Here's how I can make my point. Even saying that, I feel bad for saying that.
You don't want to speak ill of our saviors.
Or let's even take it down a notch too. I don't want to speak ill of a loved one.
Uh-huh.
Just as I would feel bad talking about somebody in my family and saying something negative about them, that's sort of how I feel mm-hmm. about Apple. Like, oh, I don't want to throw them under the bus. I don't want to say that. And I'm finding myself choosing carefully my words to do it in a way that is clearly non-biased. But that to me is actually not a bad thing. It's kind of a good thing. Like, I'm glad that there are things in my life that I want to defend and defend to a level that might not always make sense, because I would rather have passion for these things and find something that I care about enough to talk about than not care at all about it. Now, my question is when that is actually worthwhile and when that isn't. You know, this is the old thing, right? To once again go back to the video game thing. I remember being young and first hearing the term fanboy mm-hmm. and hearing about these people who loved Sony so much that all they did was talk about how terrible Nintendo is or whatever. And Microsoft comes out and now everyone has to pick a side about whether or not the Xbox is good or bad. And some of these conversations weren't about, is this architecture good? Is this platform good? Is this developer good? It was just about, is this hurting the company that I love or not? And it gets interesting quickly when you think about how these thought processes are unconsciously becoming more and more biased as time goes on.
Hmm. Fanboys.
What a word.
It's like sports. It's like all these other very like masculine, like leaning kinds of ways of turning everything into a competition, not just a friendly competition, but a sort of dominance competition, and, you know, dismissing the other side as boys, like leaving aside the issue of how it genders the whole discussion. It's like calling people's dreams silly. It's so easy to become orthodox about technology. It's occurring to me that we've had this aspect of this conversation before on the show, and like we might take like religious language about this sort of thing a little bit more seriously than some commentators, but the parallels are impossible to deny. And it's like, because of this certainty about the way the world needs to go, that this kind of fervor comes out. And it's because this is such a long-term game and we can follow it on a day-to-day basis because things are moving so fast, but it's something that we have to follow day in and day out for years and years and years to see the trajectory, and our interest is sustained by the wondering what's going to be around the corner in, you know, multiple generations of the technology from now, in multiple generations of humankind from now. And there's really only one way to keep your head in the game, and it's like faith that the technology is going to turn out the way you hope it will, and that will lead to the world and to the kind of work and the kind of relationships that we want it to facilitate. And the differences start as business model differences in the companies that are making these things. So it's not this morally neutral standpoint from which philosophers of technology are creating the world they want to live in through engineering. It's that there is this genetic code for all this technology that is the profits of a business. And that then creates this, mediates this future. And the customers have to literally buy in to the story and believe in it and believe that it's right because it's shaping the world. I'm glad I have it too. It's very weird to have that alongside a religious community in the classic sense, with its own genetic reasons for being and for propagating itself, and its own kind of blueprints for the world that we ought to live in. It's weird to hold these two things side by side, but at the end of the day, this is the one that determines more about my life. It's very uncomfortable for me to say that, because it's not like I'm just some casual Jewish person. Like, I'm married to someone who's going to be a rabbi in a year, and that's going to be our community. And so, like, of course that determines a lot about where my life is going. But in terms of my livelihood and my way of expressing myself, this is what it's all about. And my wife is writing her first book right now as part of her rabbinical career. And the best way for her to do that was to use Pages, you know?
Right.
It's all bound up together. And it's not surprising that people get all incensed, but nor is it surprising that people come together at these conferences and just kind of share the joy of it together, because they're all on the same path.
When I think about the future of my religion, when I think about how the church is going to be changed, I typically think about it through the lens of technology. And when I think about technology, I usually think about it through the lens of community, which I would say is probably the primary thing that I care about when it comes to religion. And so, you know, it's back and forth. It's all connected. One of the things that I think about a lot is how different it would be if Apple would not have, in a sense, won. Because when I cared about Apple first, years ago, they were undoubtedly an underdog. Mm-hmm. And when I think about them now, if I'm being honest, I still sort of weirdly think of them as an underdog sometimes.
Yeah.
Which is obviously not the case when you look at their value and the amount of money that they have in storehouses around the globe. They are anything but an underdog. They are...
It goes back and forth between number one and number two most profitable company in the world.
There is no doubt about the fact that they have won the war, and whether or not they can continue to win the war, you know, that's always up in question with technology as things shift. But it is not hard to be an Apple fan, because Apple is everywhere and pervasive. And I wonder if I would have a different perspective on this tribe if it wouldn't be the one that was winning. Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, I feel it's, I mean, this is really interesting conversation in its religious parallels also.
Indeed.
And stop me if this sounds absurd.
I'm excited.
It would be really interesting for us to compare across religious lines how we feel about this, because one might argue that Christianity has won.
Right.
But by definition, Judaism is the underdog forever and must remain the underdog forever and can never win. So the fact that we ended up with fairly similar tribal instincts and the same tribal loyalty, at least in one axis, suggests to me that underdog mentality is part of identifying with an in-group, because there has to be an out-group,
yeah,
and that it isn't really about the objective up or down circumstances of the tribe.
Interesting.
There's certainly more to explore on the religion side of that question. Like, Christianity, first of all, is the religion of the holy underdog. and that's what Christianity is essentially about. Or the more maybe kind of postmodern version of it, which is definitely something I've heard you say, is that, like, actual Christianity is the underdog
of Christianity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. As I just think about this, to kind of go full circle back to Apple, I do think that this is maybe an important part of feeling like you are part of a community, is you have to feel like the community is small, and maybe you have to feel like the community is at risk.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps that's why we end up feeling like we have to come to the defense of a company that is one of the most profitable things ever in existence.
One of the least risky propositions on earth right now.
Exactly. But here you are talking to one person who might not upgrade their iPhone, who still has an iPhone.
Yeah.
It's not even like they have gone the full Samsung route or something. They just have refused to update the old one. But here you are having to talk to them and explain to them why they're wrong and they need to get back in line with the way of the tribe.
It's a little bit troubling to me, actually, that anxiety maybe is one of the central motivators of this kind of group mind community. And there's a part of me that thinks that it's inherently unhealthy to have a tribal mindset because it's not a cooperative, it's not a fundamentally cooperative outlook. It's not an outlook about human existence that says we all live on a single planet together and have to coexist and cooperate. It's one that says this way is better and your way is worse and let's do this. But then of course it's impossible to deny that like that's the very mentality by which human beings survived. And this kind of group behavior and grouping and tribalism is the only thing that enabled the kind of small-scale cooperation that was required for survival. The parallel between that kind of prototypical like early human tribe and the developer community, the Apple developer community, who is the audience for WWDC, is actually still pretty interesting, I think. Something very interesting that's happened over the course of our conversation today is that we have blurred the lines between the community and the company. And it's not necessarily the case that the success of the company implies the success of the community or tribe. And as much as we might have to manufacture some of the feelings about their customers, the sense of concern, of existential concern, and of underdogness that indie iOS developers feel is absolutely real and still urgent. And so I wonder whether that is maybe something that we are just attaching to sympathetically as fans, because it is real. Like, I'm not actually worried about Apple at the end of the day. What I'm worried about is whether the calendar app that I like better than the one that Apple makes is going to still be financially viable. And that app is made by someone who I know. He was on the same show as you that we met on, that I did at ReadWrite, the same talk show that I did on Google Hangouts. Like, that person is real to me. I mean, maybe this points towards something that we could say is uniquely good about Apple as a platform for a community. It made it possible for the underdogs to find their 1,000 true fans. And it's actually beautifully way more than 1,000 in the case of successful iOS apps. And it's precarious because small businesses are hard. And small businesses can't compete with like Google and Apple and Microsoft directly. But because of the nature of the software business, Apple has opened up this kind of cavern in its giant mountainous empire where the small tribe really can cooperate and build a community for themselves. At the end of the day, the reason why I want to go to WWDC is because I am a fan of the developers, the independent developers who go to WWDC, because I admire them. I admire their lifestyle. I admire their life choices. I admire the fact that they could go work at Facebook and make a ton of money and not really have to think about it that much, and they won't do it. I just love and use the things that they make in a way that feels a lot more like a small town hardware store kind of relationship than a big corporate faceless commoditized transaction.
Yeah, definitely. King Queso was an example of that. OmniFocus has been very important to me at different times of my life. So it was nice to meet somebody and say, oh, you are the person that has created this thing that has like created systems and structures. When I worked as a creative director at the last organization I was a part of, my life was run by OmniFocus because I always had like 15 or 20 different projects going on at a time, some of which would take months, some of which would take weeks, some of which would take days. And so it was important for me to have a place to put all of that information. And you know, that review button was like the most important structure of my day. One of the people that I met that was a good example of that was a developer named Ben McCarthy, who makes the camera app Obscura. I happened to meet him and actually ended up spending a good deal of the conference with him in some way or another. Like, we had a little group of people that would go from place to place, and he was part of that group, and I got to talk to him quite a bit. And it was interesting to say, oh, like, this faceless camera app that lets me shoot raw on my phone is no longer faceless. And it made me feel much more connected to those people and much more invested in their stories, which I think is important. I don't think that I was thinking, how is developer of app X, how is he doing? Like, is his app getting enough promotion? I think that because, again, Apple has become large enough, I don't really think of those things as problems, but of course they are. Of course these indie developers need to get more promotion and need to get their apps on more iPhone screens. So yeah, it was good in that way. To kind of bounce off of that, the people that make up Apple, including some of the executives, are the Apple community just as much as the people outside of it, which is, I mean, like, that's a good thing.
They're public servants in the same sense that people who go to work for the government are public servants. The problem is there are no elections, but maybe in some sense we vote with our pocketbooks as customers, and we know that when we speak out about things that the government is doing that's harming our community, the government listens and responds, and that the amount and degree to which they do that is directly proportional to how many of the good people of the community decide to go into public service at Apple.
Well, and maybe that's a good way of even thinking about my time at WWDC. It was my equivalent of visiting DC and, you know, going to
WWDC.
Yeah, it was my equivalent of going and seeing how this system that is governing so much of my life is actually working. And I think that my takeaway was a pretty happy one. Like, I am happy with this government. I am pleased with the way that it is taking care of its people. As with all governments, I would like to see certain things change. But, you know, I'm not trying to fill out a visa form and change affiliations and get a, you know, get a quick trip out of this town. So, yeah, that's interesting to think of them in that sense. And just like when I did visit DC years ago, I was happy to visit the monuments, but I was more interested in learning about the people who were doing work on the ground. The part of WWDC that was the most important to me was not the, you know, C-level executives talking to John Gruber on the talk show, or what was actually being said from any stage. It was talking to the people who have made a stake and committed a good portion of their lives to not only being a part of the ecosystem, but bettering everybody who is a part of it as well. And that's one of the things that I love about technology as a whole, and it's why I end up being a part of the Apple community and have been part of it for so many years.